Welcome to the Spoolcast. Kim Goodwin joins Jared Spool in a discussion about scenarios. Kim will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 19 conference October 27th through 29th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. And now, here's Jared.
Hey, you're listening to another episode of the Spoolcast, and I am very excited about today's episode because we are going to have a chance to talk with the most amazing, the most wonderfulest, Ms. Kim Goodwin, who we have had at so many of our events, and the reason we keep having her back is because she is like the smartest, most brilliant person we know on getting good products and designs out. And she is going to talk at the User Interface 19 conference, which is going to be October 27th through 29th in Boston, Massachusetts. She's going to be giving a full day workshop there on scenarios and how to design with them. And we are just so excited about this. And we're going to talk to her about that today. Hey there, Kim.
Hi there, Jared. You should know how to pump up a girl's ego.
Well, thank you. You deserve every word of it. So I thought today we could talk about something that's been sort of rumbling around this casing of a skull of mine, which is this distinction that I've been working out between what I'm calling artifacts and deliverables in the design process. And so let me explain what I'm talking about, and we can talk about how scenarios might fit into this if they do or they don't, which is a deliverable is something we hand to our clients, to our dev teams, to the people we're working with, and it becomes a resource that we use for the rest of the project, at least some major portion of it to come. You know, it could be wireframes, it could be usability reports, things like that. An artifact is something we put in front of our stakeholders, in front of our users, in front of our peers, with the intent that we're going to explore some idea around them. So deliverables have this sense of sort of authoritative completeness, whereas artifacts have this conversational stimulus to it. First, let me start here. Does that distinction resonate with the way you think about design process? Do you think that these two things are there?
That's a good question. I think there is a meaningful distinction, and I think it's one as a profession we maybe don't make enough. I think there's a lot of focus on beautiful deliverables for lots of reasons, and maybe not enough on some of the interim artifacts. It's interesting, though, that you say artifacts have a conversational component to them, whereas deliverables are authoritative. I think it kind of depends on your role. I think if you are, say, a consultant from outside, something that's just a conversation piece might be one of your deliverables. And in fact, if you're following a good process, it probably is. Whereas in-house, maybe it's framed less as a deliverable, right?
Yeah. But for instance, an early draft of something might be more in the artifact category, but in its later drafts, it might be more in the final deliverable category. I don't know. I'm still working through the idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a fuzzy line, but I think it's a vague but important distinction, because I think that if it's just an artifact, if it's just a thing that's meant to make an idea more concrete so that other people can discuss it, then I think there's less pressure to make it perfect and precious, which sometimes we can do with our deliverables, right?
Right, right. So, you know, a whiteboard sketch of an architecture, for example, or a concept diagram might be more in the artifact category, whereas that same diagram in a PowerPoint slide that is saying, this is what we figured out we need to build, and we're all in agreement of this, that's more in the deliverable category. It's a concept map, and in fact, it may not have evolved from one to the other very much. But the way we use it, the context of use, I think, probably changes dramatically.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the determining factors in my head would be that context of use. And so I have this little construct in my head that I think of as the avocado model of teams, which is, well, you know, why not? Avocados are delicious, so why not compare our teams to them?
Well, I'm wondering if eventually it evolves into a guacamole model.
Maybe after a long project it does.
So that things get mushy in my head.
It's true. So in my head, the way I think of it is the center of the avocado, right? The big, hard brown nut there is the generative part of the team. Typically just a couple of people working pretty much hand in glove, creating ideas, driving synthesis of other people's ideas. Not to say that ideas can't come from outside that pair or that threesome, but somebody's really got to pull that together into a coherent solution. Beyond that, you've got some close collaborators. You know, maybe that's a couple of core engineers you're working with if one of those people isn't in the center of the avocado, a product manager, a subject matter expert. Who's in which part of the avocado is going to vary depending on your organization. But it's a small handful of people who need to review your work probably every few days to make sure you're really on track and you've got everybody's expertise incorporated. I think that's a great group of people to look at artifacts because they don't need a lot of explanation. They have plenty of context. Whereas I think when you start to get to that outer skin of the avocado, the more distant stakeholders, say the people funding the project or folks who maybe are major decision makers but aren't that involved in the day-to-day, they need a lot more explanation than you could include in something that's just an artifact. Those are the people you need the PowerPoint presentation for. To my mind, it's sort of how close to the day-to-day is someone is really what determines whether you need an artifact or more of a deliverable for that conversation.
I think that's really interesting. That's not something I had considered before. This idea that part of what distinguishes what I'm calling artifacts versus deliverables is how much outside explanation do you need to be able to look at this thing and derive insight and provide insight in reaction to it. Fabulous, fabulous. I think that's really neat. So now this gets me to the question I wanted to ask from the very beginning, which is if we talk about scenarios and personas, do they fit into either category or both categories? Or maybe what you're telling me is they are in fact both an artifact and deliverable, but when you have them as a deliverable, you have to put more story around them, more explanation, whereas when they're in artifact mode, because of the people you're talking to and where you're talking to them in the process, you may not need to do that.
Right, right. I think you're right that they're both really. And this is one of those things that depends on where you are in the design process. It depends on which part of your audience you're communicating with. And I think it depends also on the culture and the size of the organization that you're working in. So if you're working in some tiny little startup, you have a small team, you all sit across the hall from each other or around a big table or whatever, you don't really need a lot in the way of formal deliverables, right? This is one of the arguments that the Lean UX folks make. And I think it's absolutely true. You don't need formal deliverables when you have the two pizza team, as people call it. But when you have some enormous team of 40 engineers, 50 engineers, more than that, and they're spread across a couple of continents and many time zones, and you have varying skills on the team, you've got some people who are really experienced, some people who are not that experienced, that's when you have to get much more formal about deliverables. And they have to involve a lot more explanation, and they have to be done with more detail.
That makes perfect sense. You know, it occurs to me as we're talking here that we haven't really defined personas or scenarios. So maybe we should take a step back and just introduce those people for which these ideas may be a little new for them.
Sure, sure. So a persona is an archetype. So for any given product or service, there's several different behavior patterns that you're designing for. If it's an enterprise setting, chances are those patterns have a lot of similarity to roles, although they're usually a little more complex than just a role. You'll often have several personas within a role. In the consumer world, those behavior patterns tend to center more on attitudes and goals and things like that. So for any given product, you might have two or three personas. You might have six or eight personas. You could have more than that if it's a really complicated enterprise tool. But there are a set of behavior patterns and goals distilled out of ideally qualitative research. You can certainly supplement that with quantitative research, but they represent a type of user, and they do so in a more human way than just a user profile would, because they're essentially the stars of stories, which brings us to scenarios. So if a persona is your character, the scenario is your plot. So imagine putting your character in a situation. for any product or service, you generally are going to have multiple scenarios, situations that your personas will encounter that are going to unfold in different ways. And the scenario is the ideal world version of that situation. So if you put a magic black box in the hands of your persona, what would happen in this situation? How would that story unfold? And then we use that to guide the design going forward.
I like that you pointed out that scenarios and personas were about behaviors, because I think a lot of people fall into the trap where they make them about, you know, census data and job titles and things that are not necessarily behavioral. You know, three people with the job title nurse may have completely different sets of behaviors as to whether they're a nurse in an emergency room versus a nurse in a pediatrics doctor's office versus a nurse in a nursing home.
Absolutely. I think that people will often conflate personas and roles if you're looking at a business context or some non-consumer context, because they sound like similar constructs, but context, skill level, those definitely make a difference in how many different personas you have. So for example, if you've got an IT guy in a small company versus one in a large company, the guy in the small company is responsible for the phones, the database, the network, probably the copy machine, anything that plugs into the wall is his problem. And his level of expertise with any one of those things is probably relatively low. Whereas in a big enterprise, that same IT guy is just responsible for one system.
Yeah, just the servers or just the routers.
Right. So, you know, job titles can be really deceptive that way. But yeah, that's very important that personas are much more nuanced, much more about behavior. And demographics are just not that enlightening in most cases when it comes to personas. So I see a lot of people with huge persona sets of 20 people for one fairly simple product, and they're making a bunch of meaningless distinctions based on things like demographics that don't really matter, when in reality, maybe they have three personas.
Yeah, yeah. But then I've also seen teams, you can tell me if you see this too, which have the two personas, new users, existing users. And they bundle everybody into those two categories, again, without taking any consideration that there might be different sets of behaviors to look at within people who might be exposed to the product for the first time versus people who've been using it for a while, but you know, some people use it every day and some people use it infrequently, and what they do with it is different and all those things.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that one. I don't see it as much as the overemphasis on demographics, though, interestingly enough.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. You mentioned earlier Lean UX, and for people who might only have a vague notion of what that is, Lean UX is this, I don't know what you would call it, a movement, a variation, a dance, a song genre. It's a way of approaching the design process that de-emphasizes long-term deliverables and focuses on sort of faster iterations and movement with small teams. Like you said, the teams that could be fed out of two large pizzas happily. Is that how you would qualify it? Something similar to that?
I think so. And, you know, like any emphasis on a method, it's one of those things that works great in some contexts and I think is less appropriate in other contexts. So, you know, there's no one right way to do UX. It's all about assessing what's the culture you're in, what's the size of team and the type of problem you're working on, and picking the right tools from there.
Right. Right, right, right. So let's get back to this idea of scenarios as discussion pieces for artifacts. Is there something that has jumped out at you recently where you were like, oh, wow, because we had this conversation about the scenarios of our users, we were able to move this project forward in an interesting way that we wouldn't have gotten to otherwise?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it happens all the time. I think that very often I'll see a designer who maybe has a single image of a static screen. And then we have a conversation about, well, what's the scenario here? How does this actually unfold? How does this screen change over time? And that identifies a hole in the design, just in a design critique session. This happens a lot with stakeholders looking at a design and saying, well, why didn't you design it that way? Or why don't you have this feature or this field or whatever? And then we can have the conversation about, well, what's the scenario in which you'd use that? And by the way, which persona is that for? And sometimes people realize, oh, yeah, that's kind of my pet idea. I guess it doesn't actually make sense. So, you know, it's good for containing scope and opinion. And sometimes it's great for coming up with whole new ideas. But I think really that goes back to not just the scenarios as a tool, but the research that informs the scenarios and really looking at what is that user's whole experience? How would they frame what their experience is? Because I find a lot of teams, particularly those who are focused on agile tools like user stories, they're so focused on making their scope very small that they're not necessarily thinking about the entire breadth of the flow from a user's perspective. And very often, you know, the user experience is more at the epic level in agile terms than at the story level. And so scenarios really look at the whole picture, that whole experience, part of which might even be outside of your product. And that's where I think the big wins are.
So thinking about this, right, a user story might be, you know, as a customer, I want to tell the e-commerce system that I need to return this particular order. But the scenario could possibly talk about the larger context of why I'm returning the order. Maybe I ordered the wrong thing in the first place, and maybe instead of fixing the return system, we should fix the way I chose the product.
Right. The scenario would actually start with, I need to buy a thing. Let me find the thing. Did I get the right thing? And then would follow you through the return process, because all of that is interconnected. Because when that persona arrives at your website, he or she has certain expectations about what you already know about her. If you only start with the return process, well, does that persona remember when that purchase was made? Or what are all the things we should already know about her? What should we be anticipating? And how could we, of course, ideally prevent that return? So yeah, a scenario really looks at that whole process of the relationship between product or service and person.
Right. Okay. That makes perfect sense, because in the olden days, if you wanted to return something to Amazon, you had to go find the Amazon order number for that product, which was printed on the piece of paper that was in the box that I may or may not have kept. And now I just review my orders and there's a return this button. I never actually pay any attention to the order numbers. That element of the design has become almost useless to me, even though it's essential to the underlying database. I don't need to know it because I'm looking at pictures of the products I've bought. It's obvious which one I want to return, and I never think about the order number.
That's exactly right. And in fact, a scenario about that purchase from Amazon would also include the fact that at some point you get an email that says, hey, review your experience with this product or with this Amazon market seller, because we're not just focused on the one tool. So if we think about the way organizations are created, chances are, and I'm speculating here, there's probably somebody at Amazon who's just worried about those follow-up emails. And that's their piece of the system that they're responsible for. And so if they only thought about that part of the interaction, they're missing opportunities to really make that a more integrated experience, to make it more delightful, to minimize my effort as a user by taking their knowledge about me from one stage of the process to another stage. And so scenarios start there, and then you can divide up your scenarios into much smaller pieces based on what your specific product responsibility is or what user story you're working on that sprint or however you chunk your work.
So returning to this thing that keeps gnawing away at me about artifacts, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that I could have one scenario that will actually be a discussion multiple times through my development process, because I keep coming back to it. I keep saying, but what about the scenario where the person buys the thing and then returns it? And I may be working on reviews. I may be working on the original purchase part. I may be working on, you know, the order processing. I may be working on applying credits. I'm working off the same scenario each time. Does it happen that people might, you know, as they dive a little bit deeper into the problem, start refining and reflecting on that scenario a little bit more?
Absolutely. So I would say that scenarios happen at several degrees of granularity throughout your project. So early on, at the stage where you're being optimistic and you're not so worried about constraints, because you ideally want to spend at least a couple hours there on any given project, That first scenario is totally broad. It's end-to-end process, may cross multiple channels if you're in the e-commerce world or something like that, could cross multiple platforms, and it's optimistic. Then as you proceed, you're going to scope that scenario down a little bit because there are constraints in the real world. And so that crazy thing you imagined that sounded great, we're not going to be able to touch that for another 2 years, right? So we'll leave that alone. Then we might focus on just part of that scenario and then flush it out with a bit more detail. And as we start to design that part of an interface or an interaction, then we can put more details into it as we start to make implementation decisions. And so, you know, certainly we're adding color to that. We're also, as the project proceeds, doing variants. So initially, we want to pick some very typical but very specific situations to use to illustrate our design, but not worry about all the edge cases. But over time, of course, the design has to ultimately accommodate all the weird things that people do, or even all of the semi-frequent things people do, but we don't want to drive the core of the design. Gradually, we get more and more into those as well. So it's interesting now that I've been thinking about your deliverable versus artifact distinction, and I would actually add a third in there, which is that sometimes scenarios are deliverables where we write out the prose and we have beautiful storyboards and we put it in a PowerPoint or a document and we use it, you know, to educate lots of people about the design. Sometimes a scenario is just what you'd call an artifact where it's some bullet points we've outlined on the whiteboard and some storyboard sketches. But sometimes there's even a lighter weight version, which is not even an artifact. It's just a conversation. So very often, somebody will have a sketch on a whiteboard or a set of storyboards on the whiteboard, and we'll say, okay, that looks like it works pretty well for the scenario we were talking about, but what if this happens? What if this is the situation? How does the design adapt? And we kind of talk through that as we sketch, but we don't ever even document it. We're still using scenarios as a design tool, but there's not even a written scenario artifact of any kind. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's just an oral discussion of what happens for this thing. And maybe that thing is like a story we keep hearing from the support people. I would imagine technical support is a great research resource for those edge condition scenarios.
Yeah, sometimes. Right. And we don't get to those until later in the process. You know, the early scenarios are much more informed by, I find ethnography to be a really great tool for starting those.
Because I can definitely see that.
Yeah, you get a lot of breadth from people and you really focus on those key situations and just spending time with real users, getting them to tell you their stories. That's the perfect input to scenarios as design tools.
So let's explore the deliverables for just a few minutes here. So at some point, using your avocado model, which I really like, we need to make that sort of broader group, the folks who are sort of on the skin or outside. Maybe they're the onion and the tomato that goes into the yoga, right?
Back to the kamali.
Yeah. So these people need to figure out, you know, who have we been designing for and what do we think these people do and how did we map? So now we're sharing deliverables and I could actually imagine a presentation where I'm actually there to present the design that I've created, but I start by talking about the personas and the scenarios to give context to the design. So in some ways, the deliverable at that moment isn't truly just personas and scenarios, but it's this combination of here are the people, here's what they need to accomplish, and here's the design that we have imagined that will help them accomplish this. Maybe we compare it, the same scenario, to the old design so we can see where the pain and frustration is. And we can compare and contrast so that you can see how this new design has improved it. Is that something that makes sense?
In general, yeah. I think it varies a little bit depending on the type of design you're doing, whether it's more greenfield design or more iteration.
By greenfield, you mean?
You're inventing new stuff. I think that's a little different from iterating something that exists right now. So the first thing I do before I say here's the persona in the scenario, though, is here are the real humans we talked with. Here's what we heard from them. Ideally, you all joined us for those interviews so that they're real to you. And that way, the personas are not this thing that we made up out of whole cloth, but instead, they're a shorthand for the real people we've all met. So one thing that I like to do is drag stakeholders and team members along on user interviews, because then if they join, say, 3 or 4 user interviews, and you're doing more than that, they will see enough similarity and also enough difference in those interviewees that when you talk to them about what you heard in other user interviews, they believe you in a visceral way that they don't if they didn't participate in any of the interviews.
Right. And if they've only gone on one, then they think everybody's just like that one. So you have to actually do more than one, right?
Exactly. That's why I always push people to join, say, 3 to 4 interviews, because that's enough to give them a flavor without them latching onto that one person who, by the way, happened to be a little bit odd and think that that's the whole world.
Having them see 3 or 4 interviews, doesn't that give them sort of a healthy respect for the complexity of the problem? Because the odds are those 3 to 4 people are going to be so radically different from each other that they're going to go, how the hell are we going to design anything for this variation?
Well, I think actually 3 or 4 interviews is enough for them to see both similarities and differences, because they'll say, oh, I heard this theme come up over and over again.
Yeah, people keep talking about that.
Yeah, when we start to say, here are the big trends, they go, yep, yep, I can see that. Oh, I didn't hear that one, but I believe all the other ones. So by extension, I'm going to believe the one you're telling me about now.
Adds a lot of credibility to that. I could see that completely.
And they see the differences. So they certainly do gain a respect for that. So ideally, you want to get people bought into all that research before you ever show them personas. I see a lot of teams that say, ta-da, here's our finished persona set.
The posters on the wall.
And posters on the wall are fine, but they should be reminders. They shouldn't be introductions as much as possible.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So I guess there's a sort of you're doing it wrong rule if the first time I see the personas, you know, the first time I think about these things, I haven't had any research, so I'm getting introduced to the personas that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm cautious about the phrase you're doing it wrong, because I think there's a lot of different circumstances out there. But I would say that if you're a close participant in the team's decision making, then yeah, you probably are going to be a lot better off if you have had some firsthand experience with the research. If you have a giant team of 100 developers, you can't get everybody out there to do the user research right away. And so sometimes inevitably, some people will meet them for the first time. But as much as possible, yeah, that core team, the creamy center of the avocado, you really want to get them involved in the user research.
But I'm wondering if, you know, going back to the deliverable thing and looking at the outer skin of the avocado, if it even makes sense before I start talking about personas, I actually start talking a little bit at least about the research. We went out, we visited these people. Let me introduce you to some of the real people we met and the real problems they had. Now let me show you the personas we created based on those.
Exactly. So if you are trying to get people bought into your design for the first time when you show the design, you have already lost.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because buy-in starts not just with the design. It doesn't even start with the personas. Actually, I don't even think it starts with the research findings. Buy-in, in my experience, starts with defining the research plan. So when you get the stakeholders around the table and you say, I have some thoughts on who we should talk to. What do you guys think? That's a really important conversation to have with all the right stakeholders, because if you come back with research findings and somebody says, oh, but you didn't talk to this kind of person.
Right, right.
You already lost the argument.
Those are not our real users. You need to talk to our real users.
Exactly. So you've got to start buy-in with the research plan. So, you know, even introducing personas and scenarios, you need to start earlier than that with checking in with the stakeholders, making sure everybody's aligned.
Yeah, this all makes crazy perfect sense. I'm loving this stuff, Kim.
It's good stuff. It's always fun to talk with you about this, Jared.
Good. It's good. Well, I'm very excited about UI19 because you're going to come in and you're going to do a full day workshop where you're going to walk us through exactly how to build these things out and how to use them in our work. And that's really exciting.
It's always a great conference. I look forward to it.
And that workshop that you've done it a few times for us now. And every time it's one of the highest rated workshops we have. So I'm so glad you're coming back. So I'm looking forward to it. So for those of you who would like to attend the workshop, it's going to be in Boston in October, October 27th to 29th. It's called the User Interface Conference. You can find out more information at uiconf.com. And we'd love to see you there. It would be really awesome to have you there. Hey, Kim, thank you so much for spending the time talking to us today.
Thank you, Jared. My pleasure.
And I want to thank our audience. Of course, you can check out the conference site and you can learn more at uie.com. And you know what? If you have a chance and you really like these podcasts, if you could take a moment and visit the iTunes library and leave a little rating there for us. And even if you don't like it, go ahead and do that too. But particularly if you like it, we'd love to hear your feedback and to see what's going on there. So take a moment, do that. Thank you for listening today. And as always, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
For more information about Kim's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. As always, thanks for listening.